Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. How was Germany governed during the pressures of the First World War, and what caused the shortages that delivered so much hardship to its civilians? In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about wartime in the Kaiser's Reich.
The First World War unsurprisingly placed major strains on German society. I think it's worth pointing out that did not lead, of course, to a search for a compromise or peace. Instead, with the politicians, including the SPD, the left, unwilling to be effectively critical, the army, in effect, became the directing pivot of state and economy, and there was, in practice, a military dictatorship from 1916 onwards. And I think that casts some light on arguments that maybe the British or the French should have made or could have made more of an effort to reach a compromise peace, because the military dictatorship were really not interested in a peace unless there were major territorial gains for Germany, which would in effect be a reward for its aggression. Furthermore, I think it's fair to say that the German leadership proved almost incapable of making rational decisions. For example, bringing the Americans into the war in 1917 by resuming unrestricted submarine warfare, which, you know, nearly led to a war in 1915. The Germans had ceased the unrestricted submarine warfare because of its concern about the impact on the United States. It resumed it in 1917 because of a serious misunderstanding of American and German relative capabilities, and also the extent to which submarine warfare might bring Britain to its knees. And such an analysis, I suppose, though you could argue, assumes a rationalist balance of risks and opportunities. And as I've already indicated in my criticism in the last programme of Sleepwalkers and other works that present Germany as a sort of rational actor in 1914, I think this misunderstands the nature of the army's impact in German policy. And by 1917, there was even more an ideology of total war, a rejection of the idea of compromise, a virulent Anglophobia, which was linked to the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare. And this was part of a more widespread legitimation of violence and militarism of both society and of German options, as it were, and a determination to find a way to victory. So in a sense, World War I sees a precursor, albeit without the genocidal pattern and without the messianic ideology, of many of the cultural inclinations that we're to see in World War II. As far as the army is concerned, neither Wilhelm II, the Kaiser, nor the Reichstag was in a real position to exercise control. But I think it's also worth pointing out, and you know, this is a caveat that needs to be made. There is a sort of worship of the military in many societies, including Britain, where, you know, if you're a failed general or an officer that didn't make senior military rank, you seem to consider yourself possibly capable of running the country. It's worth pointing out that the military wasn't up to the challenge in World War I Germany either. It found it very difficult to run a war economy and a war society, and there were major problems. For example, manpower shortages affected both the army and the economy, creating competition between the two. And due to a lack of coal miners, coal production fell in 1917. And this is a society really largely dependent, one might almost say totally dependent on coal as its industrial fuel, fell in 1917. That in turn affects the rail system. Railways in this period are largely powered directly by coal. And that from 1916 was also under great pressure due to the focus on steel production to manufacture armaments. And the cumulative impact of such shortages was a decline in the economy, its growing atomization, and this hindered attempts to coordinate and direct production. It's also worth pointing out that serious food shortages, which, you know, it's easy to blame on the Allied, principally British blockade, but a lot is due to the nature of the German war economy, greatly damaged civilian morale and reduced both energy, calorific energy that could be used for work, but also resistance to disease. Food rationing was introduced in April 1916, and it became a contentious issue in large part because potatoes, which were the staple of the German diet, were in short supply. And this helped lead to an emphasis on turnips, the turnip winter of 1916 to 17, and to food shortages and labour unrest, including in such major centres as Düsseldorf in the summer of 1917. Malnutrition becomes a serious problem, and food protests in which women play a major role were frequent in both Berlin and other cities. Now, for the Germans, for the German military, the panacea appeared to be victory. So there was a determination to win territory and resources from Russia as part of the terms of peace in 1918, but there was no realistic strategy for victory, and pressing the German domestic population harder helped undermine public support for the war. And you know, you can debate how far that affected the army. I would argue that it did affect the army. The army was aware of attitudes at home, and you know, we see growing problems with poor morale in the army from 1918 onwards, a crisis in the army, loss of fighting resilience and unit cohesion, and officers by August 1918 feeling that they could no longer rely on their troops, many of whom deserted, surrendered, or avoided combat. So, you know, there's a sense of crisis. The sense of crisis also is communicated by the impending collapse of Germany's alliance system. And this helps to lead the army to seek an armistice. You know, to that end, following the resignation of the cabinet on the 30th of September, a new government based on the majority parties of the Reichstag was appointed on the 3rd of October under the chancellorship of Prince Max of Baden, the heir to the Grand Duchy of Baden, who was a moderate. And I think it's worth saying that by then, by the 3rd of October, quite clearly the war politics has come to an end, and we're moving towards the coming of peace, which is to pose all sorts of new challenges for German politics and society. So maybe we ought to pause at that moment, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I want to start with the point you made very early on. So, you know, from 1916, the military really take over the government. Should we see the political response and the structural response to a war which is dragging on much longer than its protagonists originally imagined? Do we see a way in which these structures develop and change? Is the Reichstag meeting throughout the period of the war, or is it reduced to an irrelevance? How does the nature of government change over the course of 1914 to 1918?
Well, as I've said, I mean, what I would see is I would present it as a military dictatorship. And I would also point out that, you know, you don't expect in wartime to have the same degree of maintenance of peacetime arrangements. So, you know, in Britain, There's no general election, that's postponed, which had not been the case, incidentally, during the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. In France, there's a degree of consolidation, and I think it's fair to say a sort of prescription of politicians who won't sign up to the war goals as they develop. But I think in Germany, the problem is that the military take over the leadership itself. Now, you can debate, if you like, whether there was sufficient control over Haig on the Western Front from the point of view of the British government, and you would find British ministers at the time who were concerned about strategy. But ultimately, strategy is set in by civilian politicians, and with parliamentary accountability remaining in place. And when there's a wartime coalition, so the broad the basis of elite politics is widened, whereas in Germany it's narrowed. The Conservatives are brought in, as indeed a Labour. And the then when Herbert Asquith is felt not to be up to the job, there is the political manoeuvres which lead to David Lloyd George becoming prime minister. Now, I don't think, however much you might want to gloss German politics in an optimistic light, I would not see the same process as the case in Germany. I would argue that in practical terms, strategy is shrunk to operational factors, politics is shrunk to operational factors, and that leads to a mishandling of strategy, and in fact, a situation in which different policy options are not being advanced, which compromises the German ability to respond to the international position that they're in. That would be my argument. Now, you'll find some people who are more sanguine about Germany in that period. I have to say, I think they're wrong on both military grounds and political grounds.
Mm. And the attitude of the SPD, the main left-wing party, is supportive throughout this period, or does it start? Well, the period after the spring offensive in 1918, things fall apart quickly. But until that time, essentially, is there very little organized opposition to the war itself within Germany?
Well, I suppose it depends what you mean by organized opposition. I would say that if you're going to compare it, for example, with what you see in Russia in 1917, no, there is no comparison. If you say, though, that what exactly is the option for politicians of all types who aren't taken into government, the answer is the option is very limited. And that's where I would put the SPD. They clearly were not going to present themselves or be willing to be presented as treasonable, but what they were part of was a political system which was kicked aside, really, and there was no effective accountability of the military to political leaders. Now, the accountability of the military to political leaders is not always desirable. After all, in Germany in World War II, that means accountability to Adolf Hitler. But the civilian politicians in World War I were not like that, although they were frequently vilified by the military and their supporters, who were apt, even before the war ended, to complain vociferously about what they called being undermined on the home front. So, and you see in those arguments a opposition to socialism, an opposition to Jews, an opposition to civil society, an opposition to conventional and legal political means. And I think it's fair to say that that was already in place.
And the power that the military operate from 1916 is, how does that affect the role of the Kaiser?
Well, the Kaiser's reputation with the military prior to the war was not always as high as it might be, which is one way of saying that tactfully, that many of them thought that his ideas I mentioned last time of ending a military review with the grand charge of fixing military manoeuvres so that the side and the means of combat he wanted won, many of them were unimpressed by that. I think it's fair to say that he becomes, from the point of view of the senior military figures, who from 1916 are Hindenburg and Ludendorff, he becomes rather of an irrelevance.
In the British narrative of fighting the war on the home front, it's portrayed as a kind of 1914-1915, you have this laissez-faire Edwardian liberal government, which is trying not to subvert everything in the British economy and British society to the war effort. This is in the shortened version of events. And then from about 1916 onwards, particularly when Lloyd George becomes prime minister at the end of that year, there's a much more of a determined effort with the state taking more control. And in the British narrative, this is seen as increasingly successful. What you're saying about the German experience is that actually the increasing control by the military didn't have that success, shortages, bad planning, and so on.
Yes, I mean, if you want to be more positive, you'll point out that the Germans were able to increase the size of their artillery, to produce more shells, to, as it were, support a longer war than they had envisaged, and still mount major offensives, 1915 on the Eastern Front, 1916 on the Western Front, 1918 on the Western Front. But as I've indicated, the problems that they were having with supplying sufficient coal to keep the railway system going, with coping with the contradictory requirements on steel and on coal and on manpower, all of which incidentally prefigure problems they're to have in World War II, indicate a mismatch between the aspirations and ambitions of the military leaders for campaign success and the strategic fundamentals. And I think that that is a serious issue. In the case of, you mentioned the comparison with Britain, well, the comparison with Britain is partly that this is a more successful and better managed war economy, but also linked to that, integral to that, is it's part of a more potent alliance system. I mean, obviously, the British have Russia, which, has major problems, but then you wouldn't exactly say Austro-Hungary or Bulgaria or the Ottoman Empire are major sources of economic resource for the Germans. But the key thing is France is a major economy, and the British Empire is very significant, and Britain also, it's paying for it, but is able to purchase the industrial benefit of American industry and agriculture. So that I think that there is a stronger economic basis. But I do think leadership is significant. I mean, for example, the allocation of coal within the alliance structure between Britain and France is handled much more proficiently than the sort of, I was about to say methods used by the Germans. I think it's fair to say that there wasn't an adequate understanding of the pressures placed on coal supplies and the best means of dealing with those. The Germans loot resources, which helps their war economy, again, in anticipation of World War II. So Belgium, coal and iron and French, you know, from the area around Longwy, which the Germans conquer, benefits Germany, as does, say, Romanian grain and oil. But ultimately, they just simply haven't thought it through. And as with World War II, there is a deeply flawed strategic lack of understanding about the need to match viable military goals to reachable political ends. And I would argue that the Germans fail seriously in both world wars.
And as the war is prolonged much beyond initial expectations, is it your feeling that the France and Britain are part of an international financial system with support from the United States, which allows them to endure and fund a long war in a way in which the central powers, they don't have that access to the international financial system, and therefore, the property they can loot is their main way of sustaining themselves?
I wouldn't go as far as the latter. Germany is a significant economy in 1914, and it remained so during the war, and there's no equivalent to the dislocation and damage caused by Allied bombing that you're to see in the combined bomber offensive in World War II. But I would say that the looting of the economic resources of conquered areas is but a part of the, as it were, mix and match, ad hoc, expedient nature of German policymaking. And people aren't used to seeing those words ascribed to German activity in the 20th century, but that's a reflection of their failure to understand what was really going on.
For Germans on the home front, was the Royal Navy's blockade of Germany militarily much more impactful on their lives than anything that was happening on the Western Front until the very closing stages of the war?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I mean, obviously, most Germans would have sons, fathers, husbands who were serving in the armed forces, and the Western Front, therefore, would be very impactful in those terms. But insofar as we're talking about living standards, the Allied blockade was highly significant. And that helps to account for the tensions about the supply of potatoes, but it also helps to account for the hopes raised of obtaining resources from the East. And again, it's rather interesting here. This is a precursor of the German situation in World War II, where first allied with the Soviet Union, closely allied from 1939 to 1941, and then at war, but conquering large chunks of it, Soviet resources were seen as the panacea for a German public otherwise under pressure from essentially a British blockade. In World War I, the British Navy was hopeful that by 1921, 1922, a blockade would lead to the collapse of civil society in Germany. Now, obviously, war came to an end in 1918, and you can debate how far the blockade and disaffection on the home front was responsible for the move change in German policy. I mean, I think it's fair to say that there's a mismatch here between many historians of German social history who are apt to argue that the home front was crucial and therefore that the blockade was crucial. And they almost, though this isn't their intention, borrow the Hitlerian idea of a stab in the back, or they would rephrase it, because these tend to be historians, in fact, on the left, that the popular will changes and brings down the German elite. Whereas I think it's fair to say that military historians are more apt to argue that the German army was defeated, that it mishandled seriously its spring offensives in 1918, that it was defeated by the improvements in Allied tactical and operational art, and that this caused Ludendorff and Hindenburg to decide they wanted an armistice. And that, you know, that decision was not driven essentially by developments within Germany. So there are different approaches you can take. You won't be surprised to hear that I favour the latter, partly because, you know, as you know, I've written extensively on World War I, my book, The Great War, but partly also because I think that the argument that the domestic front led, in particular public agitation, led to a change in the German military leadership rests on aspiration rather than evidence. In other words, I think many of the historians would like to feel that that was the case, but the smoking gun, I think, is somewhat absent.
Mm. I mean, when the collapse comes, of course, it does come very rapidly, and different players in the drama are proceeding on assumptions which then don't play out. With the military high command, and I'm thinking primarily of Hindenburg and Ludendorff, when they decide to pursue an armistice option, they do so under the misapprehension that they will get reasonable terms from the Western powers, or were they, what was their thinking?
Well, that's a lovely term about reasonable terms. I mean, they had started the war, and I think Germany does get reasonable terms out of World War One, and the terms are considerably less tight than out of World War Two. So I'd use a different phrase than reasonable terms. They recommended an armistice because they wanted to preserve the army and allow it to play a key role in post-war German politics. And partly to do with that, they also prepared their narratives of failure, part of which was to do with arguing that Bulgaria's decision to seek an armistice was undermining the German alliance system. But it's interesting to note that the Supreme Army Command on the 2nd of October, in a briefing to the leading politicians in the Reichstag, emphasized the situation on the Western Front. So Ludendorff saw an armistice as the basis for an honorable rather than a dictated peace. And he saw this as being, it was, in other words, partly the means of the peace as well as its content was absolutely crucial. Now, Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, the American president, speaking to Congress, made a distinction between the German people and the Hohenzollern dynasty of Wilhelm II and the high command. And that opened the way to negotiations on the basis of political change in Germany, and was why, in a sense, Prince Max of Baden was appointed. Ludendorff had a different view. He saw an armistice and the subsequent peace as a way to discredit the left and to maintain a continued control for the military elite after the war. So roughly what happens, we'll play it through very roughly. On the 4th of October, Max of Baden appoints Wilson, approaches him to make peace on the basis of the 14 points that the president had outlined to Congress. Wilson demands via a note, diplomatic note on the 14th of October, that Germany be transformed into what he sees as a liberal constitutional state, and that the armistice terms be such that the Germans be unable to renew hostilities. This is a very important point. The army, in other words, wasn't to be allowed to remain as a force that could re-enter the stage. Now, that was a point that Britain and France were particularly insistent on. Not least, they had civilian armies, pressure to go home. They didn't want to begin to demobilize and then find that Germany rejected any terms. The Allied leaders and generals indeed initially thought the conditions offered to Germany would be judged unacceptable, and that the Americans would have to help them win an outright victory. But on the 17th of October, the German War Cabinet accepted Wilson's terms. However, Ludendorff and Hindenburg had moved to deciding that the terms weren't good enough. Partly, I suspect, we know, are because they were concerned with what they saw as their honor and the honor of the army, et cetera, et cetera. So Ludendorff denounces the proposed terms on the 24th of October and is sacked 2 days later. Meanwhile, what you're actually getting is with the apparent failure of the army, it's being pushed back on the Western Front, the political crisis in Germany is spreading. And the mutiny of the sailors in the High Sea Fleet on the 27th of October helps to act as a key precipitate for rebellion across much of Germany. And this is within Germany itself. The High Sea Fleet is based at Wilhelmshaven on the North Sea. That also thwarted the idea of the German naval command for a final sortie to begin on October the 29th, leading to a fight to the finish with the British Grand Fleet that would again preserve, as it were, the Navy's honour as well as its political position in the post-war world. You can think here almost as if you're talking about Japan in 1945. Now, I think it's possible that you've got elements of a counter-revolution being sort of brought forward. That certainly can be suggested by that plan, by Wilhelm II's decision on the 28th of October to leave Berlin for the military headquarters at Spa. But in the event, support for the war in Germany and confidence in victory has by this stage largely collapsed. And there is an impetus now for political change, in part because there's a vacuum at the senior levels in the military, and there's nothing really to take its place. So what you get is the Social Democrat Party are pressing for a new political order, including a degree of democratization. And, you know, Max of Baden is trying to transform the constitution into a British-style system. On the 3rd of November, Wilhelm II establishes a civilian government in the east, which had previously been under the military government, the large area of Germany's conquests. Which creates the idea of a sort of German sphere in Europe. But the continued Allied advance, and the Allies are now moving into Belgium, they've broken through the Hindenburg Line, they're doing extraordinarily well, robs the army leadership of confidence, creates a sense of inexorable failure. And Wilhelm II, put under pressure both from Max of Baden and from Wilhelm Groener, who was Ludendorff's replacement, Wilhelm II is driven from the scene on the 9th of November in the face of what appears to be an incipient revolution. Max unilaterally announces Wilhelm's abdication of both the imperial and Prussian crowns, and that Crown Prince Wilhelm, his son, has renounced them. So in other words, in effect, the new government has ditched the Hohenzollerns, and a new provisional Republican government, which was established on the 9th of November under Friedrich Ebert, the Social Democrat leader, was eager to end the conflict in part because, like everybody else, there's a worry that if they don't get it right and quickly, that maybe something will go wrong in the sense of possibly Bolshevik takeover, as in Russia in 1917, or something even more chaotic, different directions in different parts of Germany. So Wilhelm flees to Doorn in the Netherlands and becomes essentially irrelevant. Groener, believing peace to be necessary, allows the army to, as it were, both end hostilities and uses it to back up the new infant republic, and peace terms are agreed in negotiations in that railway carriage near Compiègne. I imagine travellers in Britain this weekend will be able, stuck in railway carriages, to envisage more than a new order in Europe. So you've got and this acceleration, which is really quite rapid in 1918, the end of 1918. And, you know, it's not only the case that the Germans are thinking this. I noticed in the correspondence of General Henry Horne on the 2nd of November, Horne was one of the talented British commanders of that period. He commanded the advance of the British First Army, which had captured Valenciennes that day. And he wrote to his wife, quote, "I think we must not be too," and he italicized too, "severe with Germany in case of there being a breakup there, and we shall find no government to enforce terms upon," which he then put an exclamation about after. "Bolshevism is the danger. If it breaks out in Germany, it might spread to France and England." So already, in a sense, there is a post-war mandate being considered against the background of apparent instability.
Well, I want to end with really a question about this interesting role of Prince Max of Baden. He's no revolutionary, as you say. He's trying to create a constitutional form of government more similar to that in the United Kingdom. And yet he plays a primary role in forcing not only the Kaiser to abdicate, but essentially turning Germany into a republic. Is he driven by panic, the Bolshevism of which you've just spoken, and you know, the rebellions and Bolshevik governments in temporary governments in Berlin and Munich? Is this what drives him, or has he decided that the game is simply up for the Hohenzollerns?
Well, I mean, you've made a point. He's not he's not really a Hohenzollern. He's from a different German princely family. I think it's fair to say that there's a measure of anger. I mean, first of all, he's being prudential, so all credit to him. Second of all, he's willing to compromise, all credit to him. Thirdly, I think you have, with him and with other figures, an interest in different political solutions as something of interest. And I mentioned he was interested in the sort of a British-style system, a kind of limited monarchy with an effective parliamentary government. I mean, obviously that wasn't viable. So what he's in essence going for is the nearest, which is a kind of democratic parliamentary government, but without the monarchy.
Well, the system that follows post-monarchical Germany, we will pick up with the Weimar Republic in the next issue. But for taking us through Germany during the Great War, Professor Jeremy Black, whose A Brief History of Germany is published and out now, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.